Ryan, for 20 million rupees, the secret to making the best cup of coffee is A. Spending lots of money. B. Adding a lot of sugar and cream. C. Having it made by a barista. Or D. Starting with freshly roasted beans.
He's my phone a friend. He's my 50-50. Okay, D, starting with freshly roasted beans.
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
Well, Ryan, you have answered correctly! Congratulations! You have just won 20 million rupees and somehow also the love and freedom of your way out of your league girlfriend. But I have good news for listeners at home. You don't need to be a millionaire to enjoy exceptional coffee. You just need to switch to Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that remembering to buy coffee can be crossed off your list of things to worry about. And right now, Sparkplug is offering a special deal to Top 100 listeners. If you enter the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your order. The discount doesn't apply to coffee gear, but it does apply to any size coffee order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? There's never been a better time to start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Get started right now at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, hello, film freakazoids, and thank you from Canada to India and back again for lending some time to the next 100 project. Careful, we spoil movies. I'm the bona fide hustler making my name, Ryan Ellis, and here's the bona fide game show enthusiast and second musketeer, my wife Bev.
That's me.
Paper Planes by MIA. Had no idea it was even this movie. It was fun to hear it. So the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Slumdog Millionaire. Slumdog is the most recent Best Picture winner that didn't get a single acting nomination at the Oscars. What are the last three movies that won Best Picture but didn't get a single nom for any of the actors?
They were The Last Emperor, Braveheart, and Lord of the Rings, Return of the King.
You're absolutely right! Well done. There was a bit of a trick question there, in a way. Not that I intended it to be that way, but someone else could read it this way. Because I did word it last week a little differently than I just read it now, the question itself. Braveheart, Mel Gibson's an actor. He was nominated for directing and producing. But I meant as an actor. And it's noteworthy because one of the reasons that some of the movies that have won Best Picture in those splits of picture and director, it's because it's the actor's movie, like Crash, or last week Shakespeare in Love, or even 12 Years a Slave. The bigger casts tend to get rewarded the Oscars over the maybe technical movie or the movie with a smaller cast, for example, because more actors are in the Academy. So all right then, the next 100 Project's 95th flick, Slumdog Millionaire, built its reputation at all sorts of festivals, especially at the Toronto International Film Festival, before it was sicked on the USA on Christmas Day 2008. Had a small budget, but it was a pretty large hit. Bev, I think you need to tell people the skinny on Slumdog.
Dev Patel is Jamal, a chaiwala at a call center in Mumbai who has stumbled into the hot seat at the Indian version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Millionaire!
Where each question gives him an opportunity to reflect back on the unlikely circumstances of his life up to this point. His years spent orphaned and hustling to survive in the city's vast slums, his on-again, off-again relationship with his brother Salim and his childhood sweetheart, Frida Pinto's Latika, who happens to be the real reason Jamal has come on the show in a romantic attempt to get her attention and lure her away from the criminal life she has settled for.
Or, in a nutshell, tea peddler's really shitty life wins him a lot of money. It's a hard knock life for Jamal. It's a hard knock life for Jamal. Rotten Tomatoes numbers on this film. 92% of critics like the film. 248 fresh, 22 rotten, and 90% of audiences also like it. It was 16th at the 2008 U.S. box office. What was number one? Can you guess?
2008? Was it Avatar?
Was the
that Avatar?
Dark Knight. Avatar was the next year.
Dark Knight. Oh, right, of course, Dark Knight.
Was number one. Iron Man was number two, and Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was number three. So what do you think of the movie that is a combination of Slumdweller and Underdog? Because, of course, people did criticize Slumdog. What's that mean? Well, that's what it means, according to Danny Boyle, the director. So what do you think of this movie that neither of us have seen in a long time?
Yeah, I remember really liking it a lot back in 2008 when I first saw it. I can't say I still have the feels for it. Maybe it's just one of those movies that's really great the first time you see it. But now, 10 years later, I enjoy it. It's an incredibly entertaining movie, but it just seems to really skirt on the surface of what's happening, and I never get emotionally invested in the characters' lives, despite some pretty intense stuff happening. It's just always rushing to the next action scene or joke or whatever, jumping around in time. It's good. It's a really good movie, but perhaps it's not aging very well.
I guess I'm in about the same camp you are. It's certainly not my favorite from that year. I'm a Dark Knight guy, also The Wrestler and Wall-E, and many others. This was not even in my top 10 for what that's worth. But ironically, it was the favorite going into the Oscars, despite the fact it is an underdog-type movie, along with being an underdog story. But it was the festivals where it played, and everyone started talking about it so much. And I remember hearing about this only a little before it actually came out into the regular theaters and thought, I've never even heard of this movie before, and suddenly it's this movie that everyone had to see. And when it won the Oscar, it was easily the favorite. There's not a lot of other great movies that it was up against. Milk is my favorite of the other nominees, and I think the best movie of the five of them that year. And this is the last year, by the way, where they only had five nominees. There was that controversy that Dark Knight didn't get recognized as even a nominee. And so ever since then, we've had anywhere from, I guess, seven has been the fewest ever since, as many as 9 or 10. It can go as high as 10.
I agree with you that Milk, out of the five nominees, was probably the best film. But man, now, 10 years later, who could possibly argue that anything but Dark Knight should have won Best Picture? I understand that's not the type of movie that typically gets rewarded by the Academy, but it's the best film of that year. It's remained in the zeitgeist for all these years, and it's probably even a more important film than either of those.
That's true, and Slumdog was also released, at least in part, by the same company that did Dark Knight, Warner Brothers. Also, Fox had a hand in this movie, but it was made independently. And eventually, a movie does begin after many vanity credits. We sit there and watch logo after logo after logo. It's set in Mumbai in 2006, and it's interesting that prior to 2004, when Million Dollar Baby won, Best Picture winners generally were not contemporary. Sometimes they were set way in the past. Other times they were set at least 20 years in the past. And there have been some, like No Country for Old Men, after Million Dollar Baby in 2004, that have won, or 12 Years a Slave, which of course is hundreds of years ago. But a lot more often than ever used to be in the last 15 or so years, you see movies that are only a few years old, or even literally supposed to be that same year you're watching it. Crash is a contemporary film, The Departed is, and obviously Slumdog is. There's a lot of Hindi in this movie, so it is a foreign film in a way. It's also not produced by a studio, and it's got Indian and Scottish cast and crew primarily.
Yeah, Boyle intended intentionally to have the whole film in English. They cast kids from India who didn't really speak very good English. And it was the idea of the casting director, I'll say this wrong, Loveleen Tandon, who said, you know, just let them speak their native language. Yeah, of course it's going to be a little weird, but it's better to just, like, get a better performance out of them. And it must have worked. Their performance is amazing. Those kids are absolutely fantastic. Loveleen Tandon's contribution, she got bumped up to a co-director. She was casting director, but Boyle said that her contributions were just too significant, so he upgraded her. She also did all the translations for the kids. She translated the English script into Hindi. Boyle just said that he relied on her to ensure, because she is Indian, that he didn't make any huge mistakes portraying India.
Yeah, she was not at the Oscars, or at least was not with him when he went director. He went up there by himself. I think he talked about her in his acceptance speech. I'll definitely post that clip of the acceptance speech on our website. But she wasn't recognized with him like she could have been. And you can't say, oh, he never recognized two people, because the Coen brothers, the year before, won as co-directors.
Yeah, that's silly. Of course the Academy would recognize two directors.
When this movie took off from the festivals, I think one of the reasons why people started talking about it so much to other people was the spirit and the sense of fun and the Bollywood ending as well, the dance number at the very end. But most of the film is very dark. Their mother gets murdered. There's other murders in the whole picture. There's child abuse. Kids get their eyes, not, I guess not burned out, but they're blinded. There's implied prostitution and slavery, effectively. Latika seems to be both a pro and a slave.
Yeah, there's some surprisingly effective, troubling stuff in this. I mean, I'll never forget that scene of the kid being blinded. It's actually one of those scenes I wish I could unsee, because it makes me so upset in a film that's supposed to be lighthearted. And maybe that's kind of what elevates it to the type of film that was considered Oscar-worthy, prestige, what have you. Because it didn't shy away from the serious side of life in slums. Now, of course, that being said, anybody who knows anything about India, like, one of the criticisms the film has received is there's no way that these boys could have emerged from the slums as intact as they did. being bilingual and
literate. Fluently bilingual.
Yes, yes. And even as many people have pointed out, people in India don't even really like the film, and one of their biggest problems with it is not even just that Jamal speaks English fluently, but he speaks it with a British accent, because Dev Patel is a British actor. If you learn English in India, you don't speak with a British accent, you speak with an Indian accent. So it's kind of laughable to them that they have this inaccuracy. But he did attempt to, I think, show life in the slums as realistically as he could. It's sugar-coated, there's no doubt about that.
The reason why they know English, according to the trivia on the IMDb, is that because of all the time they spent near the Taj Mahal and just doing what they do when they're being hustlers, that they would learn English from all the tourists. I don't know if you'd learn English that well doing yeah, those things, right. But you'd learn to get by, at least, so I'll buy that. And your explanation about Loveleen Tandon saying, let's let these kids speak in their proper accent, or this proper language, I should say, is the reason why. So that's why you have to let that go, because they were supposed to speak English and didn't, because they couldn't. So, okay, we'll have to let that slide.
Like, the film is kind of a fairy tale. It's really just asking you to go along with it and enjoy the ride. We all love a good rags-to-riches story with an impossible romance thrown in. There's just enough, I guess, whimsy in it that you let that stuff slide.
We talked about dark stuff, and one of the more dark things is that Jamal gets the Mel Gibson Lethal Weapon torture treatment from the cops. I think it's the first time we see him as the adult Jamal. And of course, you don't know at that point why this is happening to this poor guy.
How would you torture somebody to find out?
Over a game show.
Game show. That's so overkill. This is one of the things that bothered me rewatching the film, is this notion that they suspect he's cheating. The film could have used the structure of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire without adding in this subplot that they suspect he's cheating and don't believe a slumdog could win. You can incorporate some of these elements without the whole police inspector business and the torture. It's so much.
Earlier on, though, and we see so much of this in flashback, the three different versions of the three main characters as little kids, little bit older kids, and then as the grown kids. But when we see them as the littlest kids, the garbage-strewn Mumbai, Trump would surely call this a shithole country from what we see on screen anyway. Fucking asshole.
Trump would love to reduce all of the regulations that stop people from throwing trash in American cities and rivers. And so,
but not many movies cover a kid in poop.
Oh,
and this one does.
That is a memorable
scene. And I think it shows that little Jamal will do anything to get what he wants.
And their hustling ability is the reason that they survive and why they kind of manage unscathed. He's this unflappable kid. He's just such an enduring spirit. I think that's probably the reason people love the film, is that Jamal is just such a lovable character. He can't be beat down, and he could be covered in shit and still...
I'm a tub!
Yeah, he still is like, I got the autograph! And then even when his brother sells that autograph to somebody... He still loves his brother. Even at the very end, he still loves his brother, I think.
That should take the air out of the sails, that scene, I think. A lot of movies, maybe that would have been a more key plot point, that he is betrayed by his brother in the very next scene after that great majestic thing where he's covered in shit. I've got it! The autograph! But then his brother sells it, and you'd think normally that would be a bigger plot point than it is in this movie, but it just goes to show that Salim will do whatever he has to. But that Salim's a deep character, because when they're the middle version of themselves as kids, he saves his brother from being blinded.
That's when they're little.
Okay, there you go. All right. Well, anyway, the point is Salim does that for Jamal, but he also does terrible things to him throughout the film.
He's a layered good-bad guy, because he does just enough selfish things to look out for himself, to keep the tension in their relationship, and ultimately to commit a sin in their relationship that is unforgivable, which is to hold a gun to Jamal's head and insist that he should be able to have his way with Latika. I think Jamal just wants to protect her.
He loves her from the very beginning. Salim certainly doesn't. Well, there's a recurring theme in this movie of trains, and that's also a Danny Boyle thing. Train spotting is the movie they put him on the map. But you see Latika get left behind at a train station when they're running away from those guys who are trying to blind them all. The ending, of course, takes place in a train station. And then he sees Latika, that recurring shot, that great shot of that beautiful woman looking up at him, at a train station as well. But since we're talking about trains, train spotting, Danny Boyle, interesting director. This guy's been around for a long time. He's made a lot of different types of movies. The one thing they always seem to have in common is energy, dark humor, that sense of style, brutality as well.
Yeah, darkness.
And there's also always running in a Danny Boyle movie. The drug addicts in Train Spotting, The Infecteds in 28 Days Later, and then The Indians in this movie.
Those are great three movies to talk about, because I think those three movies share what is probably considered Danny Boyle's distinct style. Really quick cutting, it looks like a music video. My criticism off the top that the movie doesn't resonate emotionally for me. People might say, well, that's because it looks like a music video. That's because he's employed this style of really fast cutting, keeping everything just too flashy to really get beneath the surface of things. But I would disagree, because I think Trainspotting absolutely employs that style, but has different pacing. Like, it slows down when you need an emotional break or when you need to just get inside the character's head. It accomplishes that feat of getting you inside the character's head, no matter how foreign their lives might seem to me, in a way that Slumdog doesn't. And even 28 Days Later, I think, does. I felt more connected to the characters in 28 Days Later, which is certainly a sillier film because of the subject matter. Mm. But I would say he made the same mistake that he made in Slumdog 10 times over in the terrible, unfortunate sequel to Trainspotting. Way, way more style than substance. Maybe there's people that he works with that can reel him in and get that style to work in his favor instead of working against him. And of course, as I say this, you know, everybody loves Slumdog, so this is definitely just my opinion. It was a little shallow.
He probably also wanted to make this movie so fast-paced and not dwell on the awful subject matter the way he might have a little bit in Trainspotting, to try to not alienate people and have them walk out of the theater.
I don't know. I can't think of a faster way to alienate people than watching a child get blinded.
But they don't dwell on that scene. They move on past it, and then it becomes all about how Jamal and Salim are leaving Latika behind only seconds after we realize what's really going to happen or what could happen to Jamal.
And you want to talk about unrealistic things, too. How likely is it that that sinister guy would have waited till Latika was roughly 13 before he turned her into a prostitute? This notion that he was teaching her to dance and getting her hair done and makeup and stuff so that he could sell her virginity for a higher cost. No way. All the years that he could have been turning a profit from her, that's so unlikely. But they had to do that so that Jamal could save her at the very last minute.
Just the fact those kids get away from him running away? Mm. No. They probably wouldn't be able to outrun those guys. Don't they also have guns?
Well, they're not going to shoot the children.
What do they got to lose?
Oh, good point. Here's something. I haven't heard much criticism about this. I don't know if people should be upset about this, but good God, does this movie ever paint India in a terrible light. Mm-hmm. That there are people, and surely there are people in all kinds of places all over the world, that suffer the way these kids suffer, that have nothing the way these kids have nothing. And when I say nothing, I mean they don't even have any basic safety. It is a miracle that these kids would make it to adulthood, let alone become a T-boy at a call center. That seems like a miracle that he just had a regular job when it was all said and done. There's very few redeeming qualities about India in this film. And I'm surprised that I didn't see any criticism that a UK, like a British person, came in and made this very unflattering film about India, because I would imagine if I were Indian, I would have quite a few feelings about who is responsible for India having the problems it has, and a lot of that could be its colonial past.
The major people behind the scenes with the authorship, Danny Boyle, Simon Beaufoy, who wrote the screenplay based on Vikash Swarup's 2005 novel called Q&A, and then the producer, Christian Coulson, all white guys and not Indians as well.
And British, right?
Or Scottish, at least.
The screenwriter, he wrote The Full Monty. Apparently, they were trying to get Boyle, they were trying to get him to work on the project, and he wasn't interested until he learned that Beaufoy was the screenwriter, because he said that Full Monty is one of his favorite British films ever made.
And then Beaufoy went on to write Catching Fire, one of the Hunger Games movies, and then 127 Hours for Danny Boyle.
Another one that employs his style very well. It may be one of the best uses of his style, because you have to make one location look so interesting, and there's a film that gets inside the character's head. It's so successful.
For a solid hour, at least, he's down there by himself. Probably longer than that.
Yeah.
The movie's about 95 or so minutes long, and of course the whole movie's not down in that pit with the rock pinning his arm, but about an hour of screen time, at least, is with him by himself.
And there's a very short list of directors that could take that story and make it work and make it as totally entertaining as it is, because it really is.
Let's talk about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the Indian version of it. Jamal knows a lot, but he doesn't know basic facts about his own country, and that's the main reason why they're interrogating him and torturing him in the police station to begin with. I never really watched that show. I saw it a few times, but I was reading you can't lose everything on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire the way that Prem says you can. You get to certain levels and you plateau. So if you're at, I don't know, $10,000 and you try to go for $40,000, I don't know how the numbers work. You don't have zero if you're wrong. You stick with $10,000.
I remember how the numbers work. So in the American version, where it's $1 million, once you've got to $32,000, you cannot go below $32,000. So he wouldn't have nothing. They keep saying he would have nothing. So yeah, that's incorrect.
You could argue that's the Indian rules, though, too, I guess. Yeah. But it's not probably true. I don't think that is true about there, because they do have that show over there. It's also got the easiest final answer in millionaire history. It's fucking Aramis! Athos, Porthos, and Aramis. Now, of course, that's the running theme about the Three Musketeers, and they never know who the third musketeer is. They don't really know probably the other two musketeers either, Athos and Porthos. But come on. You never stumbled across that in all of your years, Jamal? easiest answer of all time.
Of course, it's hard to gauge how hard the last question is because it is legitimately really rare that a contestant gets to the final question on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Mm-hmm. It made the news the first time somebody won $1 million, and it had taken months. There were months' worth of contestants. And I wonder if the big prize on that show is part of the reason why the format of that show was to draw it out. They don't want to be churning contestants through every day because every person that goes on the show, most of them win a fair amount of money. Very often people get to the $32,000 mark. Oh, the other thing is you can walk away after you've seen the question. On Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, they ask you the question, and you have the choice between answering it with the risk of getting it wrong, or choosing to walk away right there.
Okay.
And I don't think they were giving him that option in the movie. But it increases the tension, obviously.
Yeah. Anil Kapoor does play Prem, the guy who's the host of the show. He's a Bollywood star and has been working for nearly 40 years. He's pretty cool looking. He's got a very distinct look. When they all went on the stage at the Oscars, he's one of the people that went up on stage. And you could definitely pick him out. Some other people I'm looking around thinking, okay, who's that and who's that? The kid's easy to pick out, too, although I don't remember which one's which exactly. But then again, I was looking at those clips before we watched the movie, so I didn't really know who was who either. And that's another thing about the Oscars, by the way. This is one of the first times I can remember where an entire cast went on stage with the producer or producers when it was Best Picture, because the year before, No Country, the actors didn't go on stage. When The Departed won, DiCaprio, Wahlberg, Nicholson, they didn't go on stage. Scorsese didn't even go out with the producer. He'd already won his own Oscar. And the years before that, that rarely happened. Lord of the Rings, they did. Return of the King, they did. But most of the time, that didn't happen. But now, if there's any kind of cast members that are there, and there usually are, they go on stage with their director and producer and whoever else may have won Oscars at Best Picture time.
You would know. When is the last time that they didn't go on stage with the producers?
Well, they maybe haven't every single time since Slumdog, but I'm telling you, No Country. It was just Scott Rudin and the Coens that went up there.
So maybe that's the last time, because it seems totally standard.
Well, Brolin and Tommy Lee Jones and Javier Bardem were all there, so they could have gone up there with them, but they didn't.
Mm. But you can't think of an example after that when they didn't, is my question. It's been over 10 years now since.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I think other award shows are the same thing now. It's a nice touch to have everybody go up there. Sometimes you look and say, who's that? Why are they up there? Oh, right, they're in that movie.
Yeah, it is really nice. It was really nice when Moonlight won and the kids were up there. And you just think, God, what a special moment for them. It's pretty cool.
So the end of the film, the Bollywood ending, the song Jai Ho, which is a pretty cool song, it means roughly, let there be victory. And the movie ends the way the producer in The Bad and the Beautiful, the character himself in the movie, insists. He wants a kiss on the lips and black on the books. And this movie, of course, had a lot of black on the books because it made a ton of money. What do you think about the Bollywood-esque dance number during the end credits of the picture?
I like it. They took a lot of influence from Bollywood cinema. I think this is one of the things where he leaned quite heavily on Lovely Tandon to get it authentic and to make sure it really resembled a Bollywood musical ending. It was an homage. It was an homage to the cinema that he took influence from. And maybe it was a gift to Indian viewers as well. That's such a Bollywood thing to do.
Movie set in their country and largely filmed there. Lovely Tandon, we keep mentioning her name. This is the last movie that she was ever involved in as a casting director or a director or anything. I don't know why. It doesn't say online about why she's not making movies. It doesn't say she's dead, so I don't know what happened to her. Well, her cast, of course, stars Dev Patel and Frida Pinto. They became an item for several years, I guess during this movie, but certainly after it. And as you said earlier in the podcast, out of his league. He's kind of cute, but those giant ears, and regardless, almost nobody's in her league anyway.
Right. He looks great now. He's really aged into his looks, but you go back and watch this film and you're like, come on. Only under these specific circumstances would that girl give you a second look.
She doesn't seem very tortured considering what she's been through either. He's been through shitty things in his life, and certainly his brother has too. But she should be way more haunted and maybe even fucked right up considering what she's been through. But she seems like she's actually an innocent little flower. But maybe she's not the greatest actress of all time. Maybe she just doesn't sell it as well as she could, because she hasn't been in that many movies, only about a dozen in her whole career. This was her debut. She was in Rise of the Planet of the Apes a couple years later, and that's the only other big title she seems to have. But even when they scar her cheek, they can't make her look bad.
No.
It's one of those things that makes her look better in some strange ways.
I know. The idea that that's all it would take to make her ugly is laughable.
And she's usually wearing yellow, and you almost could call that the hunt for gold, just like this movie, Search for Oscars, later on.
Sure.
But it's also easier to pick her out when she's wearing yellow. Dev Patel was in Lion just a couple of years ago. He's also been in both the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel movies. We talked about those last week on Shakespeare in Love. And then he was in Sorkin's The Newsroom, which we have scorned many times. And this character does earn his happiness, just like she does, because they've both been through a lot of terrible things.
And he is a really good person. He's just so lovable, and he's good. He has a good heart.
It's funny, though, because we talked about this on Shakespeare in Love, and it's probably true about this movie, that despite some terrible things happening in this one, and not so terrible in that one, they're not very deep, these characters, are they? We don't really learn that much about them either.
That's my complaint about the film. It really does just skirt on the surface. For a film that's using some profound injustices to shock and entertain us, it sure isn't demanding that much from us. We see the horrors like mutilation and rape that our heroes narrowly escape, but it doesn't ask us to reflect on that. It just sweeps us along frenetically, too quickly to absorb any real consequences of their poverty, and the pace leaves no room for emotional resonance. You're right, we don't get to know the characters. Maybe that is a fault of the acting. You said Frida Pinto, absolutely gorgeous, seems really lovable, has a great likability quality, but we really don't have any idea what's going on in her head or what her struggles are or what her life could have been like, what she's really escaping. Again, no emotional investment whatsoever. It's like you're a stone skipping over the lives of these characters.
Irfan Khan, he's the cop who does the torturing, or at least is in charge of the torturing of Jamal. And if you recognize him, it's from Life of Pi and Jurassic World, especially. He's the guy in the helicopter, he's the one that owns the park or something, or he's in charge of the park.
Life of Pi, I saw him in The Lunchbox last year, maybe 2 years ago.
Oh, okay.
That was an Indian film.
Pretty good actor. Pretty
yeah,
good actor.
Yeah.
And I guess you say it, Madhur Mittal, or Mittal, he plays the adult Salim. He's only been in a handful of flicks. I won't name all the kid actors, even though they're all very good, because I didn't write that down, and I don't think any of them have gone on to big careers. Although, it's nice that they were taken care of after filming, because there was a controversy about what would happen to these kids. Get them out of the real slums that they were in to be in this movie.
They were really in slums?
That's what I was reading, but apparently the filmmakers took care of them and made sure that they had some kind of education, and good. I guess gave them some kind of place to live. That's what I was reading. I hope it's true. Their producer was Christian Coulson. He was the producer of The Descent, a great horror film from a few years before this, and then also Selma, a couple years after this, and has worked with Boyle over and over again since this movie. The film was 2.35:1. We watched the Blu-ray, and of course it does shine with color and pops and all that kind of stuff. The cameraman, Anthony Dodd Mantle, who's worked a lot with Boyle and also shot Dogville and Antichrist. We recently talked about Lars von Trier when we did Melancholia. Well, Mantle has shot some of his films. This was the first movie to be shot primarily digitally to win the cinematography Oscar. And I think you can see the digital filmmaking, but then that's not really true anymore about movies because you can't really tell the difference. But then I think it was almost a deliberate touch. 28 Days Later was shot digitally too, and you really could see that, although I don't think I really noticed it when it was made. I didn't really care. But when you watch it now, I've seen it more. You can pick out, oh yeah, it's digital, of course.
28 Days Later was one of the first big Hollywood films. Well, I guess not Hollywood, it's British, but it was one of the first big films made by a known director to shoot digitally. At the time, it was SD. You watch it now, it looks terrible, but they could never have made that film without the flexibility that those cameras afforded them. There's also something Lars von Trier shot, Dancer in the Dark, that way, a little more of an art film. And again, he could put cameras places that he never could have put a film camera. You'd make a completely different film when you open it up to digital shooting. And I think that's got to be true when you're racing around the slums of Mumbai. It is a huge difference to have a camera that weighs like a quarter of what a film camera would, to be able to shoot for long takes the way you can't when you're shooting on film.
Less lighting's needed.
Yeah, you have a lot more flexibility with that kind of stuff. There's a reason that it's taken over. And he was kind of one of the pioneers.
The editor was Chris Dickens, who cut Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, so he is, of course, an Edgar Wright guy. And he will be cutting Solo, or he's been cutting it, because it's probably pretty much done now, and that comes out in May. Solo as in the Star Wars prequel. I always got to ask you about the editing, and I think we've agreed that that's one of the better touches in this movie. One of the best edits I've ever seen in a movie, actually, to age characters a few years, is when they're on the train after they get away from the guys who want to blind them, and they leave Latika behind, and they have to jump off because they're forced off by these bullies. And as they're falling down into the dirt, when they come to a stop, they're older now.
But I have to actually disagree that I didn't love the editing of the film. I love the style. Okay. I think that it's very adept, their use of this particular style, and I love watching films like this. But I think editing is probably one of the ways that they could have drawn out certain scenes that we needed to sit with longer so that we could feel what was happening. So I don't know if I can praise the editing.
Okay, I think it's a strong part of the film. But then again, I missed one of the more important scenes in the movie because I fell asleep, I'll admit it. I dozed off during the scene where Latika and Jamal, as older people, meet up when she's working for that guy who's watching cricket and she has to make a sandwich for him. That is one of the slower scenes in the movie in a good way. It's one of the more let's get to know these people a little bit more kind of scenes. But remind me, did I miss anything all that important?
I think what you miss in that scene is the first time you really feel the romantic tension between them, because they're children before, and Jamal especially is so innocent and never feels like a sexual tension with Latika. But that's the scene where you feel like, oh no, these two have chemistry together. And they do sell it. As much as she's out of his league, I absolutely believe that they're in love. And when they kiss at the end of the movie, you know, you want to cheer. And that's the scene that sets up that chemistry.
And she must not agree with the out of his league stuff, because she did date him for years and years. The composer A.R. Rahman, who's done an epic amount of Bollywood films and also did the music for 127 Hours, won 2 Oscars that night for the music score and for the song Jai Ho. Music, how about that?
Oh, it's pretty fun. It's pretty good. I mean,
God. Hey, a score you liked. That.
And MIA is one of my favorite artists, and she has 2 songs in it. So.
Oh, 2, okay.
Yeah.
Well, Paper Planes is very appropriate to this movie, with the lyrics especially. Bonafide Hustler, Making My Name. Mm-hmm. It is such a cool tune that I didn't even know I knew from this movie. You told me to listen to it a few years ago. I liked it, and ever since then, I've been a fan of it. Whenever it comes on my random playlist on my phone, I won't fast forward past it. But then hearing it now, like, holy shit, I would have heard it so many times before. I didn't even know. All right, the awards and list section. The movie won 8 Oscars. Hard to believe, but it did win that many. Best Picture, Best Director for Boyle, the screenplay by Beaufoy, the Dickens editing, the Dodd Mantle cinematography, the sound, the music score, and the song Jai Ho. It was also nominated for the sound effects and for another song by Rahman. So it won in 8 of the 9 categories it could have won. It wasn't going to win 2 songs.
And I have to say, as much as I'm kind of criticizing this film, I'm really happy that Danny Boyle has won an Oscar because... even though he has some misses along with his hits, he's such a gutsy director. He takes so many chances, and I really appreciate that a director like him would get rewarded for that.
He's also one of the many recent, and I'll say maybe 20 years or so now, directors who've won Oscars who are not from America. And we've seen quite a few recently, especially. And it's pretty likely, and we'll talk about this more next week on our Oscars preview podcast, that Guillermo del Toro is going to win, and he'll be the third of his 3 buddies, Alfonso Cuarón and Alejandro González Iñárritu. Those longtime friends have all won Oscars if Del Toro does win. And I was looking at some of their Oscar acceptance speeches recently, and both Cuarón and Iñárritu have referenced the other two, so I'm sure Del Toro will do the same.
I don't think it's an accident that American directors seem to be less likely to win Oscars, because I think the Hollywood system just favors conformity and making money. You can be more creative and take more chances in other countries where they have to make film for the love of the art. Because there's not a lot of money in it. So it's probably easier to be a creative force in other countries, especially coming up there. Because once you're an auteur, then Hollywood's probably going to be more likely to greenlight your vision and let you have more control. But if you're an American director coming up, I don't know if it's that easy.
Slumdog Millionaire was a true underdog story, winning Best Picture, of course. Although, as I said, it was probably the likely winner because it was cleaning up other award shows going into this one. But even getting released was a struggle. It almost went right to video.
Till it went to TIFF, I guess. It won the audience award at TIFF, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
All right, last thoughts on our last Oscar movie this month. We did Rain Man, 1988. We did Shakespeare in Love, 1998. And now Slumdog Millionaire, 2008, as we lead into the, well, 2017 Oscars. But you know what I'm saying, 2018 show. So anyway, your last thoughts.
So even though I really like Slumdog, and no one could accuse it of being boring... I feel like it's maybe a little forgettable, and it seems to be disappearing from the cultural zeitgeist.
No one talks about it anymore.
10 years later, nobody talks about it anymore.
It's true. It's one of those Best Picture winners that hasn't gained in esteem. It hasn't really lost in esteem. It's more just that people don't think about it either way. It's not one of those like Crash or even Shakespeare in Love, like we talked about last week, that people say, fuck those movies, because they dared to win an Oscar over something else. It's more a matter of, oh yeah, that won an Oscar. I forgot all about that.
Yeah. If anybody ever told me they'd never seen it, I'd be like, oh my God, what are you waiting for? You're absolutely going to enjoy it. So you can't disparage that it won. They don't have a crystal ball. They don't know what's going to be culturally relevant 10 years from now.
And as I said before, the only movie that I liked that much more than this one was Milk. And it wasn't like Milk was my favorite that year.
It's not like I've really thought that much about Milk over the years. When I look back and I think about it...
But it's the best of the 5 nominees.
Yeah, it's the best movie of those nominees. And Gus Van Sant is another great risk-taking director that deserves to be rewarded. And of course, I just love the story of Harvey Milk. I love the documentary, The Times of Harvey Milk. So there's passion there, even though it is starring my nemesis.
Although he's fantastic in that.
He's so good in it. It's
and he
true.
Gave a great speech at the Oscars that year, too.
Yeah, I cannot disparage his performance in that film because I love Harvey Milk so much. And then to see him really do it justice, that is the only good thing you've ever done, Sean Penn. It's the only thing I've ever liked you for.
What about Fast Times?
No, I don't care
he's
about
hilarious
Fast Times.
In Fast Times.
I never saw it until I was too old to care.
Yeah, okay, fine. Okay, when the next 100 project rips into your eardrums in a week, we'll be gabbing, as I said, about the 2018 Academy Awards in our 3rd annual Oscars preview show. The coming attractions trivia. Of the 5 nominees for Best Director at this year's Oscars, only one person has ever been nominated in that category before. Which of them is it?
So for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast. And if you crave more Ryan and Bev between now and then, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, you can check out our entire roster. We've covered well over 200 movies now. That includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. We're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive.
You're absolutely right! Jai-ho!
And cut!
Jai-ho!